the Off the Ball Podcast Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to University Concert Hall Limerick for the latest Off the Ball Roadshow in association with Heineken, official worldwide partner to Rugby World Cup Japan 2019. On stage tonight, we've Knights of the Realm, World Cup winners and Olympic torch bearers, and that's just Clive Woodward. Also tonight, Scottish legend Craig Chalmers, tip legend Pat Short, Rugby Hall of Famers Brian O'Driscoll and Keith Wood. But first, give it up for your host, Mr. Joe Malloy.
Hello, everyone. Hello, how you doing? Great to be with you. It's nice to be in the home of rugby, you know. Spend all that time up in Dublin, I'm sick of them. You know, they think they're the... Well, you know what? Down here, Limerick, that's what it's all about, am I right? That's what I thought. So we've got a brilliant show for you this evening. It is all with thanks to Heineken, official worldwide partner of Rugby World Cup 2019. What are we, 5 days away now? We getting excited? We feeling good? Give me a cheer for quarterfinal. Semi-final. Final. Stop, come on. So look, I am very ably assisted this evening. Will you welcome my two co-hosts, they're going to help me quiz our guests this evening. Between them, I mean, I can't give them each their roll of honour because it goes on forever. We have 3 Heineken Cups, we have 6 Lions Tours, we have a Grand Slam, 2 Six Nations, World Rugby Player of the Year in the Hall of Fame. We're delighted they're here. They're regulars on the show, I'm sure you know. Give them the welcome they deserve. Brian O'Driscoll, Keith Wood, everyone!
Brian, hi. How are you doing?
How are you?
How are you doing?
Hi, Keith.
Hello, Drinko.
Sorry, what was this? This was like an ambush.
They're very close, aren't they?
Very close, yeah. Very close. Before we get our first guest out, because we're going to talk to him about him for the first half of the show, as we approach the weekend, how are you feeling about it all?
Yeah, good, quietly confident, just keen to get going. You know, I think the last month has been a little bit tedious, what ifs and all the question marks around selection and everything, and now the main course is about to arrive, so I think everyone's excited. You can hear what was concerned, what you left out was the group stage potentially could have been the biggest cheer, so let's not go there, but definitely just excited that we can do something that no Irish team has done before.
Yeah, I've gone for the last kind of month, maybe 2019's been a bit drab, and then the warm-up game's not so good, and now that it's here, kind of tempted to think this team will have a big performance or two in them.
Well, I think we're allowed to dream. And I think when you go to a World Cup, you want to say 15 against 15 or 23 against 23, you know, you can do proper damage down there. So we get Scotland to start. Great match to start because we can't take anything for granted. So we have to come out at a million miles an hour and see how that functions. Are we better than Scotland? We are, if we prove it for every minute of the 80. And that's actually what we expect for the team. And I think we could suddenly be in a much better position come Monday and Tuesday and say, actually, an awful lot of the negatives that we had, which were only partially negatives, but were still a little bit frustrating for us, they could be gone and we can lose a run of ourselves again on Monday or Tuesday. But I'm confident too. I think I'm not worried about the pool. I think we'll go, we'll play well. We have a good depth and squad. I'm a little bit worried about some of the injuries, but I think once we get out of that, then I'm properly worried, you know. And but then we're back in the position where, you know, disturbingly, we're a little bit most comfortable. We'll be serious underdogs, whoever we play. And then all bets are off. I think we have a cut.
Nice to be here in the home of rugby.
Oh, feels good to be home. The welcomes have gotten a lot more jovial the last 5 years than they did for the previous 15, but we've had some good shows down here.
There was only 4 people clapped that time. I wouldn't go too far into it, you know.
Let's get our first guest out. He knows what it takes to win a World Cup. We're thrilled he's here. We've never had him on the show. We'll give him a warm welcome, please. 2003 winning coach of England, Clive Woodward, everyone! Jump in there. You're very welcome.
It's good to be home.
he got more laughs than you.
They must be paying you bigger dough than me.
First time I've been applauded in Limerick, I think. So it's nice to be here. Cheers.
Have you had many Thomond Park experiences?
I came here as a Lions coach a couple of times to watch the game. So I've been here as a guest. I've never played here. I can't remember being involved here at all, is it from a playing or coaching point of view, but certainly came a couple of times for the Lions to watch the players.
So if we jump through different parts of your career here, and we'll get to the high points in a moment. It was fascinating and a bit surprising to read as well that really rugby's gain was football's loss. Clive Woodward, the 12, 13-year-old, was in love with football, obsessed with football, and father said, you're not playing football anymore, you're going to boarding school to play rugby. Is that about the gist?
Yeah, well, that's very accurate. I've never played rugby till I was 14, actually, and I was going to be a professional football player. That was my only dream, and there was one, my father was in the Air Force, and there was one famous meeting between him and this headmaster of the school. So, look, your kid's he's a bright kid, he can go to university and all this stuff, but he's just playing football. And my dad had no sort of dreams of me playing football, it was the opposite. So, because he was in the services, he could send me away to these military schools, so I got sent away to this horrendous school called HMS Conway. I actually went to a place called HMS Conway for 5 years, and they played three sports, rugby, and rugby. And that's why I was sent there, because they didn't play any football. I ran away so many times, so I started playing it. I was really small, I was playing scrum half. And so when I left there, I went to London, literally walked into Harlequins and started playing for them, and I was 18, 19. No one had heard of me, and the rest is history, really. Mm.
When you say you ran away, where did you run to, back home?
Back home, yeah, I used to wear a uniform. We had this horrendous military uniform. So hitchhiking was that easy, because I'm wearing a midshipman's naval uniform. I'm 13, 14. So I'm hitchhiking home. I used to get hitchhiking all the way back to Yorkshire. One night in home, got sent back on the train, next day back to school again. So that was it. I just get going back. So.
And what's the attitude when you say, Dad, I hate this place?
It was strange. I mean, to be fair, I never really recovered my relationship with my parents after that, you know, because I became incredibly independent, as you can imagine, because you sent away to school. So when I left school, I went down to London, literally sleeping on people's floors at those stage. Some of the players in Quinns looked after me, which was great. But we never recovered that relationship. And it's interesting when you have kids with yourself, and I was just sent to the guys. It's been a big week. I've just become a grandfather this week.
So oh, congratulations. Very good.
So, you know, when you have kids of your own, my three kids, I like to think if they're here now, we're very close. We're a close family. I spent a lot of time really, I kind of reworked on it, just based on my own experiences as growing up.
Were you a good footballer?
I was being scouted by some big teams. And that's what kind of scared my dad. And I really wasn't working, but I think that was the way you were. I mean, I was going to play football, and I was just played football, you know. And because you go on to play for England, play for the Lions, and my parents have both passed away now. But at the time, my dad would say to me, it was the right decision because I'm playing for England. And I said, don't even go there. It was the wrong decision. So, because, you know, I was watching, because we were based in Yorkshire then. So my team was Leeds. So I used to literally go as 12, 13-year-olds to watch Leeds. And that was the great Leeds team with Revy and all the superstars in playing for that Leeds team. Bremner and Gray,
Giles,
Charlton. I can name the whole team, Madeley, Clark, the whole lot. I used to go, I was fanatical about Leeds fan because we lived in Yorkshire. So I was about between the ages of sort of 9 and 13, 14. I'm in Yorkshire and I'm watching Leeds United. It was just a great team.
Clive, did you reconcile with your parents before?
Oh, you kind of reconcile, of course. But we're never close. Really, we're never close, Woody. And it was all because of that at school. I mean, we never right to the end. And they're both not here anymore. But you know, right to the end, we never kind of made up. And I've got a kind of an older sister, a younger brother. They weren't sent away to school because they weren't, you know, they didn't have this issue about playing football, and that's how it all came from. So I ended up playing rugby and. Yeah, eventually kind of started to like rugby a bit.
Do you think that drove you on more?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. I became so independent, and it was just kind of, I'm going to prove, you know. Because when you don't play football for such a long period of time, you can't just step back in it. And I literally couldn't play. And I ended up being quite good at rugby and, you know, playing for England, the Lions, all this sort of stuff. But, you know, it's just really interesting about what you do with your kids. Because to me, You know, you're there to guide them, but you're not there to, you cannot put a blockage in front of somebody because they're going to rebel. I rebelled big time.
Were they still alive, Clive, in 2003?
No. In fact, my dad died. I was in, I don't remember this famous tour from hell. So I was England coach, and I started in September, so we played a couple of autumn internationals, played the Six Nations. Then England went on this horrendous tour.
76-0, that was.
76,
yeah.
I'd forgotten the
remember
score. I'd forgotten the score.
It was a lucky guess.
It was. But if you imagine the tour today, the tour was, we flew to Australia, got off the plane, played Australia, and I'm not making excuses, but we left all the main guys behind. So we play Australia, we lose 76-0, so then we fly down to New Zealand, we play the Maoris as a warm-up game before we play New Zealand on the Saturday. We get smashed by the All Blacks by 40, 50 points. We then get on a plane and fly to South Africa to play two more tests in South Africa. Yeah, two more tests. So this tour from hell, people forget actually what it's like. So you go from Brisbane to Auckland, two tests against those guys, then we fly to South Africa, and we play a test in Johannesburg and a test in Cape Town, and we got smashed in both those games. So I've come back, I'm sure I'm going to be fired. I've only been in charge of the team for a year, but it was this amazing tour from hell. And you know, not many coaches lose to Australia 76-0 and kind of live to tell the tale. So I did. So I got my own back on a few years later.
That was Johnny's first tour, wasn't it?
Johnny Wilkinson played. He was 18 years old. It was his first cap. And Johnny Wilkins, I promise you, there was a kick in front of the goals, and he missed his kick. And it was right in the front. And he's missed his kick. I mean, you just couldn't make this up. He missed. We were 25-0 down at the time, so it was it wasn't exactly a game-changing experience, but it was quite fascinating.
76-3 is much better, 76-3, actually.
Yeah. 76-3 would have been a fair result.
To finish on this point or this thread, because it's, I guess, it's fascinating from afar to look in, given that your career worked out so brilliantly, I'm sure I accept your point that your parents just say, well, didn't it work out? You know, it wasn't all bad. Did you carry around an anger or resentment about it? Like, did you have it out with them and say, right, well, I'll see you in 10 years kind of thing, and we're not talking?
No. We just, when you go away, unless, you know, in those, you're sent to board, it's sort of merchant navy boarding school. And I'm probably one of the few rugby players that got O level in navigation and seamanship. that's what I've got. I've got a navigation. We didn't do maths and English. We did navigation and seamanship because all the kids were going to the Merchant Navy. I mean, I was this good sports person. I mean, going around the world on the Merchant Navy ship with an oil tanker, it wasn't really my idea of a lot of fun. So,
did you get the ferry over here tonight?
Or? Yeah. Well, become a matrix comrade. So, no, it was a kind of tough school. It was a kind of all blokes, and you had to look after you. And the only way you could survive, you know, with time too dramatic, you know, being good at sport helped. So, being good at rugby, being in the under 15s or 16s, and eventually captain of the team, kind of kept on the right side of these tough guys in the school. So sport helped that. So that helped, and I started to like it. But also, we didn't send kids to trials. We had no trials. No one knew anything about me. No one knew anything about me at all until I literally walked in Harlequins as 19 years old when I left school and just started playing for them.
Yeah. But sorry, then your parents, you just say, fair enough, I guess.
No, we didn't. I just didn't go home after that. When I went to London, I was living down there. I just never saw them much of them, really. Just sort of drifted apart.
Did you grow to love rugby then? Did that become, God, I see the light now. I absolutely adore this sport. Or did you always have a hankering for football?
Yeah, no, I've still love football now. I would say I did. I'm a fully qualified. It's funny, in football, I've not got a single qualification to coach rugby. Yeah, I'm a fully qualified UEFA football coach. Did all my coaching badges. And I loved it. Yeah, it was quite interesting. And yeah, it's quite interesting. I'm doing these UEFA qualifications because sometimes you've got to do these quite sort of, you know, formal assessments. So I've got this guy and I remember I went to Milton Keynes and I'm doing this 11v11, got this guy with a flip chart who's assessing me on my ability to coach this team and do all this stuff. And he just came up, and this is, you know, after we've won the World Cup and all this stuff, and he said, look, please, please, just do what you're supposed to do. I do not want to be the person who's failed you or your UEFA coaching things. So, and it's quite interesting, looking back at football now, it's one of my big kind of criticisms of the football, because the football coaching was so
methodical. It was so structured. There was no room for any entrepreneurial thinking.
Right.
And I'm kind of pride myself on a little bit of entrepreneurial thinking. I'm trying to do some kind of creative sessions. And these guys are going, you'll fail the course. And that's one of the problems in English football, I think, on the coaching side, because it is very tick box. You've got to pass. It's like passing your driving test. Just don't do anything too creative on your driving test.
We'll round back to the rugby in just a moment, but if we bookend the two parts of your career then, football early and then Southampton for that year, that got a lot of bad press, and that was a very easy thing to kind of criticise in the media. You were very serious about that. By all accounts, you say that year went very well. Harry Redknapp was good to you, and you did have two job offers that you were mulling over very seriously before the performance director at the Olympics came about in 06. So you were on the precipice around that period of becoming a football coach.
Oh, I was more than on the precipice. I was going to do it. I mean, I didn't go into football lighthearted. I mean, this all came from after the World Cup, 2003, win the World Cup. The Rugby Football Union, for those 7 years, were fantastic with me. They totally and utterly supported me. You know, I'll never say a word against them, and they really did deliver for me and what I was trying to do and all this stuff. So you win the flipping World Cup, and now I think, right, we're now going to go world domination. We are going to absolutely become the All Blacks. We're going to sort of, this is, won't be a one-off. And then literally we all fell out. You couldn't make it up. Suddenly these people who'd supported me forever, and they just thought I was out of control. They thought, you know, all this knighthood and all this stuff, winning a World Cup. And they started to try to clip my wings. And suddenly I'm going to board meetings and they're going, no. And that's why I haven't even spoken yet before I've got a no, you know. So we had this massive fallout, and that's why I left. And I was at a dinner. I was with a guy called Rupert Lowe, who was the chairman of Southampton Football Club. And I'm just telling him about my frustration. He'd read about my football. And he said, well, come to Southampton. Literally, it's a throwaway comic. Come to Southampton. And I said, well, I can't come as out. And he said, not as coach, come as director of football. You're obviously qualified to do all that sort of stuff. I'll give you 1 year in football where you get yourself fully trained up and I think you can make it. So that suddenly put this big idea in my head. You know, and it's interesting because I'd just been chosen to coach the Lions. So suddenly it's all kicking off with, you know, when I accepted the Lions job, I was coaching England. And I assumed I was carrying on coaching England. So we had this big fallout at Twickenham. So I eventually left and this often football came in. And so I went to Southampton, and it was an amazing year. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And we, in our academy, you know, Gareth Bale was there, Theo Walcott was there, Nathan Dyer was there, McGoldrick was there. This amazing youth team. And I've spent most of the time with the academy side, these kids, Bale. And it was fantastic. I started doing all my football qualifications, and I had no doubt about this. And there was nothing else in football, I promise you, that worried me at all. So it was the biggest opportunity. But what I did realise, like anything, you've got to start at the bottom. You can't just walk into a football club and say, I'm going to coach the team. You've got to earn your stripes. No different than these guys. You know who can coach, who can't coach. So, fundamentally, what happened, I got offered two job offers. One was my local club, High Wycombe, which was where Wasps play. So it was the owner was a guy called Steve Hayes. So I knew him from rugby. And he said, well, come to High Wycombe. High Wycombe were bottom of the fourth division at the stage. But they were my local team. And then I got another offer from MK Dons, a brilliant guy called Pete Winkleman, who's still there, he's still the chairman. I met him again. He came to we played MK Dons at Southampton in football. He offered me a job. They were like second bottom of the fourth division. So I was, this is where I wanted to start. And I was going to do it. I had these two contracts. And literally then I got a phone call from a guy called Colin Moynihan, Lord Moynihan, who was Minister of Sport and all this stuff. He said, look, we just won the Olympic bids. We're going to create this new job, director of sport. We'd like you to consider it. It's a six-year contract. It's Beijing, Vancouver, obviously London 2012. So I'm literally at home with my wife, Jane, and I'm sitting at this table. And she said, what's up with you? What are you shaking your head at? Oh, that's a big decision, three contracts. You know, High Wycombe, bottom of fourth division. MK Dons, second from bottom of fourth division. Or director of sport, Team GB, six-year contract, London 2012. And the first time ever she looked at me, she said, are we really having this conversation? So that's when my football career took another turn, which I didn't go into it. And there's not a day goes by, if I'd gone into it, what would have happened? Because I had to be in charge. You can't be hanging around, you know. And Southampton was fantastic. Harry Redknapp was awesome. I literally sat opposite Harry Redknapp for 6 months. And I'll never say a word against him. We had huge fun, huge fallouts, huge rows about stuff.
Right.
And I would question some of the stuff he was doing all the time. And he'd always just listen to me. And I knew when I'd won the argument, because he'd just walk out and said, listen, don't bring your Johnny Wilkinson stuff down here. And that was the end of the conversation. So that was it. But he was great. Redknapp was fantastic. And also we had George Burley was there for a short period of time. The Scots guy who was at Ipswich. So I was with George Burley. And the football guys were great. There was nothing I saw. It's a great sport. It's a tough sport. You know, people ask me in rugby, you know, you see all this stuff that goes on in football. I promise you, football is a tough, tough physical game. These guys are hard.
Was there a credibility issue with the players or some of the coaching staff? And you talk about you wanted to be the top man, but yet, you know, you need to start at the bottom. So it's kind of counterintuitive to what you're saying or almost contradicting yourself, where if you really want to go into a new environment, a new sport, you have to work your way and earn the respect of coaches and players.
Not quite.
So was that an issue at all for that year?
Counterintuitive. Yeah. I'll come to that. I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Sorry, I meant not counterintuitive. I meant contradictory.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I went to Southampton. I was not coaching the team. I was absolutely not coaching the team. I was the director of sport. I was putting in all the sports science, working behind the scene. Everyone knew. So I wasn't involved with the actual players. I was certainly involved with the academy team. They were 16, 17, which was great fun. People wanted to be there. I was coaching, doing my badges and all this sort of stuff. I was making it totally clear. I had to start at the bottom. And I was never going to coach. I'd never even dream about coaching a team unless you'd actually done it from that level up. But these two guys, these two owners, as I say, Steve Hayes and the guy from MK Don, said, no, we're going to give this a go. We think you can do it. And also, I'm a fully qualified coach now. I've done all my coaching badges. And you know, just like, you know, Ryan Giggs does and all these guys, they all go through all these qualifications. So you get your qualifications, you go from there. And it would have been interesting if I had gone into it. But you had to start at the bottom. And I said, well, these were the bottom side. These were football clubs. I had 2,000 people watching them, you know, with no budgets. They were small sides. So I don't think it was a conflict because I wasn't trying to be anything I wasn't. I wasn't trying to go in and coach at the top level. I was determined to go in and coach at the very bottom level and kind of earn your way up. But I think if you'd gone to one of those clubs and say you had gotten promotion, all the kind of people looked at you and just say, yeah, how can you coach football? You're a rugby coach. I'm a PE teacher. You know, my background's Loughborough University, did a 4-year degree in sports science. I'm a fully qualified PE teacher. If you're a PE teacher, you'd coach rugby, you coach football, you coach hockey, you coach everything. You're a PE teacher. So that's my background, is in teaching. And I happen to be good at playing rugby, so that was where it came from.
Clive, you mentioned entrepreneurial at one stage in terms of, like, you had to have pretty big balls to go and decide to be a soccer coach, a football coach, because you knew that everybody was going to say, what the hell is he doing? He's a rugby guy.
Sure.
But you seem to bring something different. I don't know, I think I met you the first time 23 or 4 years ago. You were always thinking slightly differently. So whatever the norm was, you were almost like a contrarian or changing the idea. Let's look at this entirely differently. Was that the view? Had you a set philosophy to be a contrarian or?
I sometimes just see things. I remember down at Southampton, I remember I was, I liked playing squash. So I was playing squash with somebody. And I suddenly thought, hang on, imagine if you came on the squash court with a football. How many touches would you have in about a couple of minutes? So I took a couple of footballs onto a squash court. And suddenly there's balls going everywhere. And I remember talking to Matt Letizier, who was down there, the big star from Southampton, who was just finishing playing. And he said he used to spend hours after hours as a kid just kicking a ball against the wall, just non-stop, against the wall, against the wall, against the wall. So I've gone squash court, and then I started sticking some colours on the wall and said, imagine first touch, bang, hit that ball, first touch there. You can just do so much work. So I've sat down with Harry, and I've draw my squash court out. So I've got this idea, boom, 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 do this, do this, do this. We can do so many touches within about 20 minutes, boom, boom, boom. And he just sat there nodding. And he just said, don't bring your Johnny Wilkinson stuff down here. So it was so radical to actually go on a squash court with a football.
Yeah.
And to me, it wasn't radical. It was just kind of common sense, especially when we got Letizia. Saying to me, most of his childhood was born just kicking the ball. I remember saying to Matt Letizia, what is the most important thing in football? He looked at me, just answered immediately, first touch. First touch is everything. First touch will get you to places you can never, ever dream. It's more important than pace, anything, your first touch. So I'm thinking first touch, squash court, and that's what he came from.
And he was the best volleyer of a ball of all time.
God, amazing. He never missed
top corners.
He's still the record holder for penalties, Keith. I think he's 49 out of 50. And everyone said to me, well, he's just got his natural talent. He's not. He practiced nowhere. And Matthew Tizier was a superstar in terms of a role model to how you prepare yourself to be a professional footballer. You know, you're still, but you, and I never forget, the most important thing in football is your first touch, which I agree with.
And was your general experience that football was quite backward when it came to trying new things, new ideas? Were players less forthcoming in meetings? Was that your overall experience?
No, not especially. I really loved Harry Redknapp. He was just his completely own way of doing things. I had huge respect for the players. Certainly in rugby, the way I kind of ran my rugby team, it was, you know, I like to think, yes, I'm at the top of the table in charge. But there was a lot of dialogue. I mean, I think the rugby strength is we really... I think rugby is a really well-coached game. You look at Joe Schmidt, the Irish coach, like Eddie Jones today, you know, Gatland. These guys are... and I've been, because of my Olympic experience, seeing coaches from all sports now. And I can say rugby's right up there with some of the best. But so is football. But I think then when you see... You know, one of the football managers who was probably the best of me was Arsene Wenger. I went to see Arsene Wenger because he'd heard about me, and I went to see him work. He was fantastic. Watching him coach his team was amazing.
What way?
Oh, just that he was the coach. He was absolutely, he was literally the guy putting the bibs on, putting the combs out. He was the first there, last to go. He ran the whole session. He was totally and utterly, in my words, a PE teacher. He was totally and utterly. He wasn't the guy on the side had other people doing it. He was... the coach, and his detail was fantastic, and I went to see him do a couple of sessions, and you're not surprised when then you see Mourinho, you see Klopp, you see all these guys, mainly European coaches. I just think that they haven't gone away from the absolute hands-on coaching, where you're coaching the team to be better. And that's where Pep Guardiola at Man City, he's a coach, he's a player, he's a coach, he's the tracksuit coach.
We're just going to pause for 30 seconds. I'm being told there's a slight problem with your microphone, so we're going to get that fixed, and then we'll jump back in. We are here with thanks to Heineken, official worldwide partner of Rugby World Cup 2019. Keith, I'm about to ask Clive about the England job. He started in 97 and that journey. Your perception of England around the time he took over in 97?
Sure, I hated them, of course. They were...
That's enough.
We...
Who doesn't?
Well, I think
who
you
doesn't?
Wanted an honest answer, did you? We weren't having any joy. We'd beaten them in 93 and 94. I was on the bench in 94. Simon Gagan scored in the left-hand corner and Twickenham. Yeah. And we were we had a really hard time in the late 90s. We had and it's a point I want to touch on with Clive, but we changed coach nearly every 9 months. For about 5 or 6 years, and there was not a huge amount of consistency. The squads were changing very, very heavily. Suddenly there'd be a new coach would come in. He'd only last for 9 months. He'd put structures in place. He'd have a Figueri to have a huge number of exiles players in, or let's have players that are big and very fast. Let's just put them on the wing, even if they're not wingers. And suddenly, so things kind of changed all the time. It was very confusing. And England had a really good team. You know, they had a team that had done pretty well in 91. They'd built up this aura of being pretty much invincible, with the exception of actually 93 and 94. By the time it got towards the end, they were winning really well. They were a class team. They were... doing an awful lot. Then Clive took over, and you lost on the last day for 3 Grand Slams on the trot. Is that right? Just to upset you.
I forget now.
Yeah. and just because I know Craig Chalmers will be in a while, it was called the Celtic Grand Slam, because Wales did it first, or Scotland did it first, then Wales, and then us in 2001. And what I was struck with, you talked about the RFU. What I was really struck with, there's no way in the world you'd have kept your job in Ireland with having failed 3 times, right? But they did. And then you go Grand Slam, you beat New Zealand down in New Zealand, you win a World Cup. You know, and there was, and as much and all as I love slagging Clive, and I really do, and but there is something about having a coach and keeping a coach for a long period of time. There is, you're looking for change. Change doesn't happen in a year or 2 years or 3 years. Sometimes you need the failures to really get your way to the top. And I often felt that was the case, because were you under pressure in that period of time. Because the standard in England at that stage was Grand Slams only. And you weren't getting them.
Yeah. Was that a question? No, I didn't feel under pressure. No, I didn't.
It's a long question. And a slag and a variety of
It was just, I mean, you know, I can say it was just totally planned. You know, winning Grand Slams leading into World Cups wasn't the actual plan. So we threw the last game three times. I wish. No, it's just funny that how it worked out. We had this amazing team. We got to the last game every season. Every game was away from home, interestingly enough. All three games we played were Wales. We played at Wembley, and we should have won that. Scott Gibbs caused an injury time. We lose that. We play you guys in the foot and mouth year. Remember that coming the foot and mouth year? We lose in Dublin. Then we. The only game I can honestly say that I was. We went to Scotland. I mean, you couldn't make this up. We're 4 out of 4, 1 4 out of 4. We're going to win the Grand Slam. And this is how, and I made a couple of huge errors, which I'll take you through in a sec. We're 4 out of 4. Scotland are going for the wooden spoon. They've lost 4 out of 4. We've played, so it's a complete mismatch. We're going to win the Grand Slam. Martin Johnson had been suspended. Could I have brought him back? Yes, I didn't pick him. Can you imagine that? I didn't pick Martin Johnson because the other guys, Archer and Shaw, had played every game. And we're going to win the Grand Slam. So suddenly we all get a little bit carried away with ourselves and soft, and we get beat. And deservedly so. I've watched the game. On my computer, even now, my screensaver is the final whistle against Scotland, a picture of Andy Nicol, the Scotland captain, just in this position. And that's kind of, again, that was, I say, this kind of the learnings, the pain of losing up there was huge. So, but you kind of move on. I said that, and then, you know, there was no, I never felt they were going to, you know, because I was going to go to the World Cup, that was always going to happen. And really, the first time I really felt this team can win was when we beat Ireland in Lansdowne Road just before the World Cup in the Six Nations, because Ireland, Brian's team were going for the Grand Slam. Eddie O'Sullivan was the coach. We were going for the Grand Slam. We were playing again away from home, and we won comfortably. And that's the first time I said, we really are right there. This team can go all the way. And just the timing. That's why I think, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about the World Cup, but England, I just feel almost in the same position. For some reason, they've got to this position where they're suddenly going to a World Cup with a pretty gun team under Eddie.
You spent some time with the English team and the Royal Marines early on. Can you tell us about a conversation you had with one of the leaders of the Royal Marines who had spent some time observing your team and what he said about a few individuals? And I guess maybe expand that out into the journey you guys went on to 03, because it's a very interesting observation he made.
Yeah, this was early days. So I'm from a service family. I think we all respect hugely the guys, the armed forces. So, but the Royal Marines in the UK are pretty special, you know. So I met this guy called Brigadier Piller, who was the boss of the Royal Marines. I've been doing the job about a year. So this is before the 99 World Cup, which we lost in the quarterfinals to South Africa. So just before the World Cup, about 6 months before the World Cup, I took about 40 players down to the Royal Marines in Lymston. And this guy, Brigadier Piller, put on this amazing week's program. I mean, they spent so much money. We were in helicopters, we were on boats. We were doing this amazing stuff. Anyway, we've been there literally 24 hours. And the players were loving it. We're doing these incredible exercises, and all about leadership and team building, all this stuff. And the Brigadier Piller said to me, "Can we go out for a beer?" So I said, "Sure." So I went out for a beer, and he sat there, took his bit of paper out. And on this bit of paper, there was about 7 or 8 names. And he just gave me his bit of paper and he said, I'd obviously never name these players, but he said, these players wouldn't make Royal Marines. We've been there 24 hours. So I've looked at him and I looked at this list and I've gone, what do you mean? He said, well, I didn't tell you this, but I've had all my team are all behind the scenes listening to what's going on. Every conversation's being monitored. They're trying to find out, you know, who's who here. And this list was so accurate. If I could have kind of picked my people who I didn't... I've been doing the job about a year, so it was all kind of new. But these guys have found out within 24 hours. And that list was so accurate. And I didn't kind of act on it because it was too late. I could have acted on it, but I went in with my squad for the World Cup in 99. We don't have a good World Cup. We lose to New Zealand in a game at Twickenham. We then get smashed by, we lost 5 drop goals to South Africa in the quarterfinals. You know, then I did think I was going to lose my job because that was the time. And they said, you know, and it was interesting, some of those players seeing the comments that weren't too complimentary. But then the majority of the team, the guy who would make Royal Marines, were really backing me. you know, Jono, Lawrence, Backy, Johnny, all these guys, we're going, oh, we think we're on the right track here. So I learned a huge lesson of that World Cup. And after that World Cup, I said, right, I've just got to be myself now and stop trying to be something I'm not. I'm going to just toughen up, do like I'm going to do. I'm not going to pander to these guys. And we changed the team quite dramatically. A lot of young players came in, you know, Tindall and Bolshaw and these guys. Never looked back. Mm. And between World Cups, I think we played, between losing to South Africa and winning the World Cup, well, I think I know. We played 51 games and won 45, and the win-loss ratio was amazing, including a couple of Woody's says these Grand Slam games. But that was all part of it. But we started to go away from home. We started to win in New Zealand, win in Australia, win in South Africa, and between World Cups was amazing. And we ride the World Cup as number one ranked team in the world and favourites to win. But I learned a huge lesson from the Royal Marines, because when you're lucky enough to work for those guys, they're playing for keeps. And they kind of self-select. And what I mean by self-select is you don't get on the helicopter unless you absolutely trust every single person, because they know better than anybody. One person who can't perform or play under pressure or not good enough will wipe the whole team out. And that became my mindset, and we used a lot of their stuff. So it was a big learning for me, which I didn't take on for 99, but it kind of just toughened you up, really.
Mm. You were forging a professional environment. And I remember watching a news report around, I think, the 03 World Cup, and it was all your players at laptops with their funny glasses on, and they were exercising their eyes. I wasn't sure, is he taking the mickey, or is this a joke, or is this a placebo effect, or is this real? That was an example, I think, of lots of different things you were doing. You were bringing in outside people from the CEO of Sainsbury's to, you know, hedge fund managers to watch you for a week and give you advice. Can you give us a sense of what you tried to create across those 4 years?
I think so. You get this in perspective. To win in sport, number one, you need great players. You know, to win at top level, the World Cup coming up. If you're the coach, you need great players.
Sure.
We had great players. Number two, you need great coaches. You know, the coaching of the game goes back to my roots. You know, so Andy Robinson, Dave Allred, Phil Larder, these guys were just the best. They were the best coaches. So we created this amazing coaching team, and I can't speak highly enough of that. So once that's in place, you can start to tinker. But what happens is, when you tinker, and I say tinker, you start to bring new thoughts, new ideas through. But sometimes these are, like you say, these create the headlines. Mm. But you don't win World Cups because we started training our eyes, we started doing this stuff. They just kind of underpin, and the players kind of liked it. They kind of said, oh, this is quite interesting, what it's actually all about. But the eye thing was interesting, because again, I think it was one of the players came to me, and he just gave me an article. And it's about this lady called Dr. Cheryl Calder, who was South African. She was working in South African cricket, and she just, the headline was like, weight train your eyes. And I've gone, weight train your eyes. So he gave me this article. It was all about this thing. And I had this vision of kind of dumbbells off your eyelids and thinking, how the hell do you weight train your eyes? So I literally got hold of this girl, Dr. Cheryl Calder, got on a plane, flew her out from Cape Town. Literally a day, she's in my office. She made this amazing presentation, just basically about your eye as a muscle. And if you can go to a gym and train every other muscle on your body, you can move, she's got a program that can weight train your eyes and make you more quicker in reaction time and all this sort of stuff. Now, I honestly haven't a clue whether it's complete and utter baloney, but to me, you know, just made a lot of good sense that, you know, England are weight training their eyes, which is the headlines I wanted to see, because everyone like you would be looking and go, what the hell are they doing now? And you kind of create this kind of image,
aura. Yeah.
And I was big on, I wanted to create a mystique around the team. I wasn't going telling everyone what to do. I wanted to create a real mystique about what we're doing. And it does fascinate me at times when I see coaches today sort of telling everyone what they're doing before they've actually won anything. And I've just tell everyone just to kind of keep it all quiet, keep it calm down. But we did quite a few things like that. And did it make a difference? I'm not sure. But that was my kind of role, to try and bring new things in to a sporting environment that I think that would work. And, you know, the number one person in weight training their eyes was Johnny Wilkinson. He'd used it more than anybody else. And
I did a corporate thing you did before the Lions in 2005. I had a couple of glasses of wine. It actually brought out the most competitive nature. I was well retired at that stage, still incredibly aggressive. And I was trying to press these buttons as quickly as you could. Kind of, yeah. So for visual acuity.
even if it didn't, that extra sense of competition.
It's competition.
From between players. Oh, Jesus, I have a better score than you. I've been guaranteed I'm definitely better than Draco because he's blind as a bat. But, but that would bring it up even for one of those. But you always talked about those incremental changes and differences.
Well, I remember with the United guy, I remember now, she came to see me and I couldn't decide because it's even I was going, wait, train your eyes. She said, give me one training session. Just give me one training session. So I go, okay, you got it. So about a week later, we got our training session. So she's on the pitch. She's got a little pouch. And she's on track. By the way, she's a brilliant lady. She's a hockey player, a sports hockey. And we've got about 30 players there. And I've said, this is Dr. Cheryl Calder. And then everyone stood there, all these big tough nuts, Johnson and Delaney and stuff. And I said, okay, over to you. So she had this pouch, and she just took out this patch. And she said, right, just walk up to me, every player, and I'm going to find your strong eye, your weak eye. So every player walked up to her, and she put a patch on that she covered up their strongest eye, because you've all got one eye, no matter who you are, one eye is always slightly stronger than the other. So she put a patch. So within literally about 5 minutes, I'm looking up, I've got 30 England rugby players all looking like they're pirates with these patches on their eyes. I'm going, well, what now? He said, well, I just want you to play a game. I'm going to play a game. So I've got fine. So we put 15 aside, got in the middle, say to Johnny Wilkins, right, Johnny, just kick off. Don't just kick it out of your hand, just pump it up in the air. So I promise you, he pumps it up in the air. And it underneath is Danny Grucock, who's, you know, and I'm not wide, didn't I? Danny's like this, with his patch on. The ball's coming down. And he's great. And he goes, mine! He goes like this, and the ball lands over there. And he whips his patch off. And he's like this. 29 players are on the floor. And that is the funniest thing I've ever seen. And Cheryl just said to me, there you go. That's it.
Done.
And he said, because he's got his weak eye, and think of goalkeepers, you know, if the ball's coming across, if you're on your weak side and all this sort of stuff. Mm. And he said, we've got to wait, train our eyes, we've got to get better at this and all this sort of stuff. So that kind of got the street kid.
What about the squad environment? Because you were all about having family members come into Pennyhill Park. You know, I know one player had his whole family, his wife and some kids used to come in and stay. Yeah. That's definitely kind of counterintuitive how you bond a squad. If I look at the Irish squad now, it's very much locked down within the squad environment. You focus when you're there. Yes, you can get your day away midweek, but then when you're in, you're in. So how do you sell that to the team immediately? Or the senior players coming to you going, I think this might work from...
No, there's no right or wrong here. It's like all things. If you win, you know, you're a genius, that's the way to do it. In 1999, when we did it, we weren't the geniuses, and that wasn't the way to do it. So it just depends. I just know myself. Personally, you know, Jane, my wife, comes most of the times with me. She travels with me. The kids are always there. I just thought that was the way to go. So you speak to the players. How do you want to do this? You know, I'd like to do it this way. And it wasn't that dramatic, but there were times where the wife stayed, the girlfriend stayed, and I kind of put a huge amount of just trust on them, how they were going to operate. And also I was thinking, you know, when you're playing for your club at the weekend, on the Friday night, you're at home, you're with your wife and the kids, whatever. So that's how you do it. So suddenly, if you're in an international environment, suddenly we're changing that, and it's all totally different. So really, I was trying to switch it back to this thing. I mean, I got a lot of kind of criticism for, you know, guys sharing rooms. I just think, cracky, would I as a player want to share a room with another player? When I was on the Lions tour, I shared rooms all the time. I remember sharing with Ray Gravel, and looking back now, it was great. But at the time, I'm saying, no, we've got to move on from this. You know, if you're a professional sportsman and you're doing all this stuff, I want everyone to have their own room. And also that means if your wife and girlfriend did want to come and stay, you can have your own room. But at the time, I was hugely kind of, that wasn't the way to do it. Mm. But in the end, it became the norm. And it kind of worked for us. That's all I can say. It did work.
In so much as you can, because clock's against us and we want to talk about various other things. That 2003 World Cup, does it go by, does it feel like it goes by in a second? Does it feel like an odyssey? Do you feel very early on, we are going to win this thing? Is it genuinely game by game? What are your big memories of it, your big feelings from it, the big characters that jump to mind when you think about that time?
The big memory is obviously the winning, which is just a huge relief, because I can honestly say I haven't a clue how I would have turned out, how the team would have turned out. I think when you go to World Cup, and you are the number one ranked team in the world, you're red hot favourites to win it, and you end up playing Australia in the final. If we'd not won that game, I wouldn't be sitting here now talking to you. Your life would completely change. Mm. So the relief afterwards was huge. There was no real celebration. It was just all, we almost thank God for that, you know, because the relief was huge. But what I think we did, and it's a simple cliche in sport, but I think we became really good at it, and I really did lead on this. We just went game by game. Literally, it's like, you know, England played Tonga this weekend. If I was coaching England now, I wouldn't be talking about anything else apart from Tonga. And if any player went off message and started talking about anything about even the next game after Tonga, we'd have a major fallout. And we learned to do this. And we just, game by game by game. And I sort of, you know, within reason, I'd always pick my strongest team to play for England. I'd always say, that's going to be my last game. And this is going to be my last game. I'm going to pick my strongest team. We're going to win the game. And we became really boom. And then one day, the next game might be the World Cup final. Then we'll talk about the World Cup final. And it amazes me, you know, some in, you know, a lot of the teams talking about, you know, what they're going to do in the World Cup. I think, guys, just next game. Mm. I mean, Ireland this weekend, I mean, it's their World Cup, that game at Scotland, that is their next game. But that's all you got to think about. And then win that game, move on. Mm. And that's what we became really, really good at. And I think that was my kind of biggest legacy I'd like.
You know? Yeah, that's a really interesting point. However, if you look at Ireland this weekend and say all goes well and they beat Scotland, what also happens in the other pool where they'll face in the semi or in the quarterfinals, South Africa and New Zealand play one another. Yeah. So there's a good chance if you win the pool and whoever wins between those big two nations, whoever loses, you're likely to get them in a quarterfinal. Yeah. So would you, with the knowledge that you start with Scotland, then Japan, and then we have Russia and Samoa, would you not understand that Joe Schmidt would want to pull his quarterfinal team away in the week three or week four and potentially focus on the South Africa or New Zealand quarterfinal, even though they're not there yet, but get the jump on that quarterfinal week? Could you not understand that future planning?
I could totally understand that. I just wouldn't share it with anybody. I just, you know, that would be, yeah, totally. The World Cup, we started off Uruguay, South Africa, Samoa, Uruguay. So I was always thinking about what was going to go on. But in terms of just, when you're talking to the media, everybody, just next game. So Ireland play Scotland, the next game
Japan.
Is Japan, which, I mean, that is a game that, you know, I wouldn't, because we just always assume Ireland are going to beat Japan, Scotland are going to beat Japan. You can't assume that. So if anyone, you know, and they've got Ireland got a really strong squad, but if anyone just starts to wonder, let's just think about the quarterfinal, suddenly this stuff can happen. I mean, Eddie Jones did it in the last World Cup. I mean, the biggest upset ever, Japan beating South Africa. So, yes, you can be planning, Brian. Of course you are. But in terms of your messaging to the media, to the fans, to the team, it's that next game. And let me worry about that next bit. But you don't need to go public on that.
What were they like as a group to manage? You got big characters. Like, you might give us an insight into some of them, like Johnson, Delalio, Wilkinson. I mean,
They were great.
Were they?
I think what happens is you're lucky enough to be in charge of this group of players, and we had an amazing group. We had our moments, but you know, we had this saying: "There's no such thing as a dumb idea." And I think you win a World Cup, and everyone, you kind of look in, you probably think, "Wow, this has been the most amazing place to be in." Well, it was, and it's priced. I wouldn't swap that for. There's no money would say I'd swap that experience or going to World Cup. It's just priceless. You live it forever. Because it was that good. But at times, it all kicked off. You know, and I kind of encouraged that. I had this saying, there's no such thing as a dumb idea. You know, where we'd really fall out with someone, or I'd fall out with someone, if they said to me, well, what about this? Well, why aren't you saying it in front of the group? And we started to, and don't forget, this team, they come from 12 different clubs. Some of these clubs are big rivals. You know, the Leicester, Northamptons, and they're not, some of them aren't necessarily the best of friends. But when you come into the England environment, you've got to somehow put that behind you and work on that. But they were great. I mean, I can never speak high enough of Martin Johnson, or all of them. But Jono especially was just this, he always, I'd be at the top of the table, he'd always sit there, Leonard would sit there, you know, and I'd just, you know, at times just looking at his, it was like this, going, oh, he's not agreeing with that today. So, you know, but no, they were fantastic, and every one of them, and but you just get lucky.
We had Martin Johnson at a roadshow last year, and he was almost like the pantomime villain initially, but an hour later, the whole room was just kind of charmed and loved by him. And I remember even as he was leaving, he was talking to me and a colleague about weather systems in the US, and he was just like the very smart man.
A total geek.
Oh, yeah.
But what with Jono, he would, be, you know, if, as I was pushed, he'd be he was a great player, you know, amazing captain, leader, tough as they come. But he was a great player. He'd been a great basketball player. He's a real athlete. He was just tough. But he was one of the most talented players, and he wasn't just this big lump in the second row. He was an amazing athlete, and that's the team we sort of built the whole team around him.
Johnny Wilkinson did an amazing interview 2 weeks ago in The Guardian. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah.
So basically, he was talking about how he changed as a player. So he was saying when he got to the 2011 World Cup at 32, he said, at that stage, I'd become a shell of the player I had been when I was 20, which is a very sad thought. He said, I'd had 12 years to work and grow and build, and in all that time I'd managed to do was take away the bright, shining light of my potential and turn it into a dim, weak being. When I was younger, it was 50-50. He's talking here about worry. When I was younger, it was 50-50, half of me loving the game, half of me worrying about what would happen if it went wrong. As I got older, that ratio became 70-30, 85-15. It left so little space for joy. Did you look at him in your time with him and realize you were working with a complicated, sensitive, deep-thinking person who probably had those issues or those worries?
At the time, I'm just so pleased we had him in our team, and everybody was. And I think I'd see Johnny a lot now with doing the game on Sunday with him. I think what I'd say to Johnny is, deep down, we're probably all quite similar. You know, don't think the rest of the team weren't going through worries, self-doubt, all that sort of stuff. We're all going through those. He just had it probably more than most players, but because he had this huge responsibility of the goal kicker, the guy playing 10, which is one of your key players. But that was just his makeup. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, one of the best things I've done outside of coaching the England rugby team was my job with Team GB, put me across all these athletes.
Sure.
When you work with cyclists, when you see, you're lucky enough to work with, you know, to see how Chris Hoyer and Rebecca Adlington and all these amazing athletes in different sports, they're all the same. You can see the Johnny Wilkinson in them all. They've all got these doubts, but they just drive themselves so hard, and we all do. So, you know, I read what Johnny put, and I can understand it, but I'd say it's not actually that abnormal for professional sports people to be like that. And he was an amazing guy to work with. And he was the most dedicated person. And, you know, if you see how much work he put into his game, how much he practiced, how much he trained, it was just amazing.
Yeah. When the ball goes back to him in the final, are you thinking he'll get this? No doubts.
I promise you, I'm shouting no.
No.
No, I'm shouting no, because the drop goal routine is something, you know, if you can do a drop goal in the first minute, you don't have to wait till the last minute of the World Cup final. And the whole idea of it, we're trying to drive the ball under the posts. We're trying to, you can't miss. He'd only missed two or three, so he hadn't got one yet. We'd got 30 yards out, and I'm just going no, meaning go further. Just hit Johnson, hit Delaric, keep going, because they're spreading. They know the drop goal's coming in. And the problem is, at the time I'm going no, thinking get closer, and then comes back to Johnny on his wrong foot, sails over, so I'm going yes, yes. That was awesome. But at the time I'm going no, we're too far out, don't, because this is it. This was the moment that there's no time. That was it. As long as we can catch the restart, which is another story. But it was an amazing kick, I mean, in anyone's language, because he's a left footer, and he's both, but his strong foot is his left foot, and he takes it on his right foot, and the rest is history. So, but I was pleased with my reaction, because I wasn't celebrating, I was screaming at the team to get back, because it wasn't over. Final whistle didn't go then, they had one more kickoff. And we're all over the shop, and we pride ourselves on our discipline, our organisation. When Larkham kicks off, we are all over the place. Every player is in the wrong position. I'm just going, I can see it now. You know, slow. Talk about Wilkinson, I've moved on. I can see the kickoff. And right in front of the kickoff is Trevor Woodman, our prop, our loose head prop. Trevor Woodman should have been over on the touchline, listing Martin Johnson. He's in the middle. So Larkin, to be fair, the Australian number 10, sees him. And after they've seen Woodman, and he's on his own in the middle. And they do a beautiful kick to Trevor Woodman. And I'm just going, they're going to win the ball. They're going to get another penalty. They're going to score a try. It's all going. And for so I can see it now, Woodman just ran, just goes up like a salmon in the air, this prop. And he catches, watch it, he catches the ball up here. Boom, comes thundering down to earth. Bosh. Forwards will ply and get the ball, kicks it out. And I remember saying afterwards to the players in the change room, what are we doing? That kickoff. You know, so whilst I should be celebrating the World Cup final victory, I'm still cranky about this kickoff. It was just completely and utterly all over the place. But Woodman is another hero because he took that ball amazingly.
Clive, how many times have you watched that game in full?
Honestly, in full, I don't think I have. I've watched snippets of it. I've seen bits.
I always think when someone says honestly in, they're about to
lie. Honestly, no, I'm telling you.
You watch that secretly every night.
No. You know? No, I haven't, because I've never gone back. I don't give it. I've watched bits of it. Certainly seen the last few minutes, the drop goal, loads of time, because many people show it to me. But I don't think I've ever actually seen the whole game. Mm. We didn't play that well, to be fair, but we just played better than them. And
I thought it was Martin Johnson's best game as a rugby player, not as a captain. He was extraordinary on that day.
I will share one of my favourite things about that whole experience. After the World Cup, I literally received thousands of letters from all around the world, people watching it, all these English fans and this stuff. But to set this up, before we went to the World Cup final, I hosted a lunch at Twickenham for the English deaf rugby team, you know, that's played by the deaf community. They don't have a whistle, obviously, they throw flags down, but there's an England deaf rugby team, they play in international rugby. So I've hosted this lunch for the England deaf rugby team, and I sat with their captain, a guy called Joe DeLuca, his name was. So anyway, we go to Australia, we make the World Cup final, and then in the final, for some reason, they put the coaches way up in the bleachers, way up on the top of the stands, in this like soundproof booth. And I'm in there with Andy Robinson and Phil Larder, and the referee, Andre Watson, is not having his best game, if I can be polite about it. So you see me, I'm screaming inside this coach's box, and my language has gone pretty colourful. I'm just going nuts, because I can't believe what he's doing, I can't understand what he's doing, and all this sort of stuff. So anyway, the rest is history. We win the World Cup final. So I get this letter, I get home, there's a letter from Joe DeLuca, and he went something like, "Dear Clive, just wanted to say a thank you for hosting our lunch. We had a great, great lunch, boom, boom, boom. All the English deaf rugby team all watched the game together at Castleford Rugby Club. Can we just say we all totally agree with your thoughts on Andre Watson?" On Andre Watson, the South African referee. Have you never heard of lip reading? P.S. And this is P.S. Can I become your lip reading coach? Because we know exactly what Eddie Jones was saying at the time in this coaching box. So that was my favourite all-time letter.
And last one on that England team, I want to talk to you about the Lions as well. Because we had, as I said, Martin Johnson here last year. When he's doing the whole red carpet thing in Dublin, are you in the stand thinking, I love this. This is great. This is exactly how I want my team to be. Don't you dare move for Brian O'Driscoll.
Yeah, no, it was one of those things. Sorry, Woody, but honestly, I can say that it wasn't planned or pre-done or whatever. The guy who caused it was this bald-headed guy.
We've heard about him now a few times.
Yeah, he's banging on our door, the changing room door, trying to get us out of the changing room. You know when you go away from home, especially if you're the English team, you get heaps normally. And the worst place is Scotland, that they must have a whole committee about how they can wind you up when you get to the ground. You know, they do a pretty good job, especially me, because I've lost it a few times up there. But this is a big game, and there's literally 10 minutes to go on the clock, and this guy banging on our door, get out, you have time to go out. So I go to the door, I said, what do you do? You stop banging on our door. And he's like going nuts, and he's trying to get in, and anyway. So then he, you know, eventually, and the players have seen this guy, he's at the door shouting at him, and he was the guy, when he went out there, who started to try and tell Johnson where to go. And of course, right, so John, we'd fed up with this guy, we're not going. So I could see Jono go out first, and he stood on the sort of on the left as you look at the pitch, wasn't it? It was on the left-hand side.
As you look at the pitch, it was on the right. As you look out, as you come out of the stand, it was on the right. Yeah, because we had to go down to the left, on the other side.
So, and I've seen all this in the red carpet, and I'm in the stand watching this unfold, and I did start just chuckling because I could see what was happening here, and I'm going, "Don't move, Jono, don't move, don't move," and he folds his arm. And then Backy's next to him going, "Jono, don't move, don't move. It's that bald-headed guy again who's causing us all the problems. We're not going to listen to him." And that's where it came from. And of course, it all kicked off. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't meant as any disrespectful to the president, wasn't it?
Mary Immaculate.
Yeah, Mary. There was nothing. And I was horrified afterwards. Anyone could even insinuate that, because there wasn't even, we were there to win the game of rugby, but it was just it was a moment in time that was quite amusing looking back. Mm.
The Lions, was that a job that you craved, that you dreamt about? Was that a pinnacle for you along with England?
No, not at all. I mean, the Lions, in fact, before, it was interesting talking with Brian and Keith and Craig Chalmers. And, you know, when I got picked for the Lions, and I went to a Lions tour in 1980, 1983, I remember that it was just a wow moment. So, especially in 1980, I'd only played four times for England. We'd won a Grand Slam. hadn't lost a game. I mean, I'm just in dreamland. So then I get picked the Lions tour, Billy Beaumont's tour. You know, there's lots of great Irish players. Ollie Campbell's on it. Colin Patterson's on that tour. So I love playing for the Lions. But then when you come to the coaching side, you know, when I'm coaching England, that to me was it. That was the pinnacle, you know, to coach England, to dream about winning World Cups. The Lions were something that, if I'm brutally honest, was kind of there, but it was something that was for other people to do. I had no thought about coaching the Lions. And also in 2001, they chose Graham Henry, which I thought was fair enough. So I didn't even bat an eyelid about it. I'm the English coach, and I'm very happy doing that. So then you win the World Cup, and I'm getting calls from the Lions, people saying, we'd like you to coach the Lions. And deep down, if I'm being brutally honest, I'm just going, this doesn't really fit with me because I'm English, I want to coach England. I'm going to be coaching people I've been trying to knock their heads off for 4 years, you know, in terms of, you know, the Welsh, the Scots and the Irish. You know, but I did it because I thought, okay, it's kind of my turn. I should do this. But I think that the worst thing was, you know, I then fell out with people at Twickenham over all the rugby stuff, and then the football was happening. So I got a little bit distracted. But you have to say, I threw the kitchen sink at it. I couldn't have done anything more. But, you know, like we all pick our Lions teams. I'm thinking, right, we just won the World Cup. Got this amazing team. I'm seeing this guy. Seeing Paul O'Connell, seeing various other players from the Welsh team, I thought, wow, you know, this we could go with a really amazing side. So I've got my side in my head, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to do this because at the end of the day, you know, you're as only good as your players. And I thought, we're going to have an amazing Lions team. We can go down and win. Mm. And also, it was only a few months ago I'd been to New Zealand and won. England won in Wellington. So it was every part of me, I can do this. But it kind of just happened. It all happened very, very quickly. So suddenly I'm the Lions coach. You know, and there's not a lot Probably we took a lot of coaches, you know, Andy Robinson came in, McGeeken came. I tried to get the best guys involved with the whole thing, but it just didn't work out. And when you see the team we ended up having in the various test matches, it was just a shadow, you know. And some of the players who I'd coached who were world champions, they'd dropped off. They weren't at the best. And it was a top New Zealand team, you know. I've just seen that. There's an amazing film coming out about Dan Carter called The Perfect Ten. I mean, they had an amazing team, that All Blacks team. So I can sit here and make all excuses I can, but there's no excuses. You went there, you got beat fair and square. Mm. You know, you lose Brian.
Do you regret it, Clive?
I don't regret it, no, because I don't think if someone else had done it, I don't think they would have won. If I'd gone there and deep down thought, okay, I've really screwed this up, I'd regret it. I don't think we did. Brian lasts 30 seconds, and that incident still kind of bugs me. What happened with the Kiwis? Wasn't even a yellow card. I mean, there was stuff going on. And, you know, so looking back now, yeah, we got beat. Can I live with myself? Yes. If they look in the mirror, could I have done much more? I don't think so. It just wasn't meant to be. But the team we had, you know, I had visions of Johnson playing, Delalio playing, you know, obviously Brian and Connell, all these guys. And it just didn't materialise in the end.
What were you stayed on, obviously, so what were your main observations?
Well, that was a big error on my behalf. You know, I think I realised that in 2009 when I got injured in the second test, even for the final week, yeah. I was like, there's no place for an injured player on tour. So I got myself out of South Africa, and I should have done that. I think it's easy to retrospectively look back and pull it apart. I agree with Clive. I think... No coach would have been able to come in and produce something in a short period of time against that All Black team and expect it to win the series. They were an outstanding team. Some people joke about it that, you know, Tan and Kevin Mialama did me a massive favour, actually taking me out after 30 seconds and saved my captaincy for years to come, because it was going to be a long, you know, three games trying to talk to the lads behind the posts. And we just didn't have the same caliber of individual by the time we totted up all the injuries, you know, losing Lawrence early on. You know, I think Mark Coedo, who didn't make the original squad of 42, ended up playing the first test match. So just saw the fall off. So I think it's easy to pull apart. There are some things that, you know, subsequently have changed. I think the rooming thing is a really important aspect. Yeah. I get it from a club or a country perspective, but for the Lions, you've got to force people to spend time at one another. So, you know, when I spoke to Gerald Davis in 2009, or before 2009, he said, what were the errors made in 05 and can we rectify them? And I said, that's one thing. I said, everybody, including the captain, should probably, leave the choice to the captain, but everybody should room together and room with other nationalities, because the only way you're going to get buy-in and guys to tie in, and it's a ready-made friend. So those sort of things are still unique to the Lions Tour, and I think we learned a lot from that tour. I definitely learned an awful lot. But you just have to mark it off as one of those things where it went badly wrong, and then as a result, all the negatives around it were exacerbated. So the likes of Alistair Campbell and his involvement probably, maybe it didn't help, but it definitely was multiplied on the basis of it being a 3-0 whitewash.
It was a big squad as well, and there were criticisms that the thing was split too much into two, it was too rigid, it was like two separate teams. Is that something that you stand over and think was the right approach, and that was the only approach you could take?
I don't think it made any difference to the Test series in how we worked. Would I take that number again? Yes. I think if you speak to Warren Gatland, who's done an amazing job with the Lions, he still says that's the right number. That is the right number. Whether it should be so obviously split between the midweek team and the Saturday team. You're only there a few weeks, and I kind of pride myself on, building teams, building businesses, and it takes some time. The Lions, you've got to have a different skill set, and that's why I think it suits Gatland hugely, to him to come in. It obviously suits McGeek and these guys who've got a kind of different skill set. I just need to kind of build things and get to know people pretty well, and that just, you can't do that the Lions. It's like 6 weeks, and you've got to go straight in there.
Yeah.
And Brian's right about the room, just hearing sort now, it kind of works, but if you're doing something for a 4-year period, you can understand why you don't do that. But on the Lions Tour, I don't think, would I have done much different? If I can honestly say, I don't think I would have done much different. I don't think taking any less players would have helped. We had a huge injury list, and that's what actually happened in the end. And
I don't think it was helped. There was the whole midweek team thing became an entity in itself. There are certain individuals that were particularly responsible for that. Almost, it was a little bit of, we're all right, we're doing our job over here, but the A team, are the ones that are playing on Saturdays, seem to be the ones that are struggling. So I definitely don't think that did a whole lot for morale going into the Test series, and
I didn't kind of make it up, because I remember, the Lions went to Australia in 2001 and got beat. And it was an incredibly strong Lions team. When you look at, Jono was at his best, Wilkins at his best, Brian was at his best. It was amazing. They got beat. So I'm like going back.
Keith Wood was on it as well.
And I'm going, Woody's on it. It was an amazing team. And I'm watching this from afar, and I'm getting all the feedback when the English players have come back. What happened? Why? Because I'm getting that feedback. Okay. So I kind of learned from that. So when I was put in charge in 2005, which I never applied for, they came to me. Yeah. I wouldn't have applied for it. I think, to answer your question, if it had been something you have to apply for, I was never going to apply for the Lions job. Mm. It wasn't kind of top of my list to actually get done. And I spoke to the players in 2001, so that's why we made the changes. And at the end of the day, it's a tough, I fully respect, no one respects Gatland more than me. For going to New Zealand and come away with a result like he did, with such little preparation, such little time to go away from home and play those guys, is a huge ask. We look at it common sense-wise, and he's done an amazing job.
You said to BBC Radio in 06, and this is interesting. I love people getting quotes from them like 14 years later. Yeah. But it was interesting because you said earlier on that post the 99 World Cup, you decided to be ruthless and be yourself more. You said that just tonight. And in 06, you said, I just wasn't myself on that tour. I was so conscious of trying to keep everyone happy, not cause any problems. You said, one of Ireland's players had a word with me one day and said, we're all just disappointed. You're trying to be too diplomatic. I regret not being myself. What did you mean by not
being
yourself?
That was a great quote.
Brilliant. So you were going around not wanting to offend people?
Which player. Shane Horgan said that. He was good, Shane, because he's very open on his guy. I was just having to kind of, these players from... I knew the English players inside out and back to front.
Yeah.
I didn't know the Irish players, didn't know the Welsh players, didn't know the Scottish players. These are players I've trying to knock their heads off for the last 4 or 5 years. And I was just conscious, I just don't know what to... I just wanted to make sure that I was kind of giving everyone a fair chance. And I was stepping on, a couple of things happened. If that had been an English player, if that had been on England tour, I'd just sent him home, straight home. But I know, okay, well, he's got to put up with this, and, you know, I never named the players, but I know exactly what he meant, and he was right. He was right. If that had been an England tour, well, it wouldn't have happened because the players would have known how to behave and what to do and all this sort of stuff. It was just a real eye-opener, but you kind of get through it, disappointed, obviously, hugely. Mm. But you can kind of live with yourself because, you know, would anyone else have won that series? I don't think so, if I'm honest.
Did it damage your confidence? Did it cement your sense I'm done with rugby?
Yeah, hugely. Yeah, you came back, and it's like in 99, you're kind of on the floor when you just got beat in the quarterfinal of the World Cup, and it's horrendous, and you got to kind of sort yourselves out, and it does take time, and you got to do various coping strategies. Came back from the Lions Tour in 2005, yeah, big time. You've gone from winning a World Cup and all this stuff, and then you come back, you're disappointed because, you know, the results didn't really reflect the strength of British rugby at the time, British and Irish rugby, sorry. And that was the most disappointing thing, and I can make all the excuses in the world. It's gone now, it's history. Mm. And we're never, ever going to talk about it again until I come here in 2019.
We're going to take a short interval and talk World Cup in a moment. What are you up to now? What's life now?
I've never been busy. Busier. A couple of things. I run a software company in Hammersmith, which we started in 2012, which is 66 people now. I've kind of digitized the way I coached, which is great fun. We're building a ski academy in the south of France, which is a 50 million euro build, which is a serious business I'm involved in. Do a certain amount of media work in terms of TV and the Daily Mail, and a certain amount of business, corporate coaching and speaking and support. So just busy. All my stuff kind of links in, because I'm just doing the whole thing. We kind of just kind of moved away from rugby a bit outside the media, and you kind of look in from the outside, and you kind of move on. Mm.
And so, come here, when are you going to work in football?
Yeah, I kind of, that boat's gone. I'm just doing so many other things now. Yeah. And all I know is, if you're going to go into like football, you've got to be completely, there's nothing else in your life. You've got to dedicate every ounce of your body. Mm. But you can do it. I'd say to anybody, if you're passionate about your game, if you love the game, you'll be able to coach it. If you don't love it, you won't be able to do it. If you love the game, you'll do a good job at it. So that's what I'd say to anybody. So you can cross sports. Like, people can cross businesses. You can work in different companies. You've got to be passionate about what you're actually doing. And you know, I still love football. I've seasoned together at Chelsea. That's my side. I've always watched them. So I'm still a little bit involved, but I think I've passed that now. That's got out of my system.
Well, it's been great getting your memories on your career and so much as we could. We're going to bring you back out in a few moments' time. And we are here with thanks to Heineken, official worldwide partner of Rugby World Cup 2019. But for the time being, Clive Woodward, everyone.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.